Hey, we're just about to start the class. Please hold on. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, Doug. Hey, how are you? How's it going there?
Pretty good.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, Cal.
We might have somebody else on.
Somebody else on the conference line? Yeah, Josh. Hey, Josh, how are you doing? Pretty good.
Good.
How are you?
Doing good, thanks.
Yeah, how you doing, Josh?
Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, good morning. Thanks for your message. I wrote you back. That's a good point.
Thanks.
I can hear you a lot better today, too, by the way. Usually it's a much lower, I guess, frequency or whatever. But, all right, it's good. Okay. All right, so we're up to in Koheles, and we're up to 1:12, chapter 1, verse 12. So as we, just to recap, last week, again quoting from Rabbi Chait's, you know, beautiful classes, King Solomon was describing certain primary fundamental phenomena in the workings of man, psychologically speaking, and that was necessary in order to lay the the foundation, the groundwork, to understand why we would say something is good and bad for man afterwards. We can only understand, you know, what a good surgery would be for a person unless we understand the whole human body. So similarly, in order to understand what philosophy would be beneficial or harmful to man, we first have to understand man. So that's what we did last week. And now it seems to be starting a new point, because you see that he says again, just like the first verse in the very book, he says, he identifies himself, the words of Koheles, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now again, in 1:12, he says, I am Koheles. I was king on Israel in Jerusalem. So it seems to be, again, starting over again. What's the necessity? But it could be to point out that he now finished that section in terms of one element of the book, and now he's starting the rest of the book. So he gives a similar commencement in order to, you know, let the reader know that one area is now closed, and now he's embarking upon a new part. And again, we don't look at the chapters, because that was not created by the transmission from Moses. That's just a Christian construct, in order that when they had the debates, that they were able to relate back and forth by finding verses with convenience. So we don't look at the chapters to indicate new subject matters.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I noticed this morning in verse 1, at least in my translation, and I want to see if I'm missing something in the Hebrew here. It says, the words of Koheles, son of David, king in Jerusalem, which implies present tense. But that verse 12 says, I was king.
Right.
It's implying past tense. Is there something there that we should be noticing?
Yeah, definitely. Sforno says that I had in my ability, I mean, he's now describing, I guess, at the end of his life, perhaps indicating words of the wiser king, meaning not something which he just wrote when he became king at 12 years old, but after his whole reign, and he went through his whole life, these are now the conclusions. So that I was, meaning that I'm writing this after a life of searching for wisdom.
Okay.
Let's see. If anybody else makes a comment on that. Yeah, so Rashi says a famous quote. He says, I was king in Jerusalem. So he was a king in the whole world, and at the end on Israel, and which is a little bit smaller than the whole world, and then further in time on Jerusalem alone, which is even more a smaller kingdom. He actually says on Jerusalem alone. And at the very end, he was only a ruler over his staff, his walking stick. Because he says, Nemar Hayisi, that I was, which is your very point. I was a king on Jerusalem, but the learning, the lesson from that is, but now I am not a king any longer. So what does that mean, that there was a reduction? And at the end, he was only somebody who ruled over his walking stick? What does that mean?
Oh, when you say staff, you mean like walking staff, not like his servants.
Right. Right, only his walking stick.
I could suggest two possibilities. One was I made some mistakes so that at the end I was only worthy to rule over my walking stick, or that even the idea of ruling over the whole world is kind of a vanity, and in the end, you know, it goes away too, like everything else.
Yeah, and all he had left was just a stick.
Right, all he's got left is a stick.
Yeah, I was thinking about it also. There is a bit on this in the Talmud. I'll have to go into it. And it talks about how there was a great impact that he suffered, I believe, due to this whole testing of the different lifestyles, because that's what he does now. But we still have to open up the book a bit more. So again, he's letting the reader know that he had all in his hand in order to really test out the lifestyle. For example, he wanted to corner to, it looks like the Maldim, says that he wanted to bring proof from himself in terms of what the right lifestyle is. That's why he tells everybody how wise he was. He sees people chasing around the world trying to be, search out certain lifestyles. He says, let me show you what I did, having the greatest amount of wisdom, in order that I should be a lesson to you. So he says, and again, he reminds everybody that he was a king in Israel, as Swarner says, because he had all the abilities in his hands to reach anything he intended. So don't think that I was restrained in any manner in terms of searching out any possible life. I had everything. I was the king. So if I'm telling you these are my findings, you know, give ear to this and, you know, pay attention to it. Now look at the next verse, 13. He says, and I placed my heart to inquire and to search out with wisdom on all that was done under the heavens. It is an evil matter that God has given to the sons of man. And literally it means to afflict them, to afflict him. Now it's important, again, when we read and we just look at the translation, we can be very misled, and it can seem vicious, this type of a verse. Because he's saying that I placed my heart to inquire and to search with wisdom after everything that is under the heavens. And what is King Solomon's response? He says, it's an evil matter that God has given to the sons of man to afflict him. So that sounds vindictive or vicious. So, of course, we always have to take a look at the rabbis. And Sforno, for example, says as follows. What does it mean to afflict? It means to humble him, that man should be subjugated before him when he recognizes his own lackings, when man recognizes his own lackings. And he will not become arrogant in his free thoughts, that he would think that he, in his actions, is similar to his Creator. Like had occurred to the king, Tsur, like he said, I am a God, the place of God I sit. In the place of God do I sit, this arrogant king said. So you see, the person can go that far. So what should a person do? Awful, but really what a person should do is that he should be diligent to lehidamasilav the ruts on the front of, that he should do the will of God. Okay, so when it says here that it's an evil matter that God has given man to afflict him, it means that there's something which is bad in man's estimation, but God is doing this in order to subjugate man to God. So let's really understand this verse. What exactly can we say about this? That I have given my heart over, I have placed my heart to inquire and to search with wisdom on everything that was done underneath the heavens. And it is an evil matter that God has given the sons of man to subjugate him. So what is he searching for is the first question, no?
Well, I mean, in the first part of verse 13, isn't he just searching for wisdom? The best approach, the wisest approach to live?
Well, it says he's searching with wisdom. Does it say that?
Oh, you're right. Search with wisdom. Is it that he's searching sort of for the point of all this? You know, why do we work hard and why do we struggle and why do we keep going and what drives us? Because it seems like at the end all we do is die.
It looks like you're adding a lot to what he said here. I just want to understand, again, when he makes a statement, many times it's a response to something or it has to be looked at as in a certain context that he doesn't necessarily verbalize. So again, I placed my heart, I gave my heart over to inquire, to search with wisdom on all that is done under the heavens. It's an evil matter that God has given to the sons of man to subjugate him. To humble him.
So can we presume that what he is searching for is also the thing that is the sore or the evil matter?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, he looked for X, but he ended up finding Ra. He ended up finding something evil. So what do you think what he was looking for then?
Well, if he's already gone through the first part in verses 1 through 12, as we talked about last week, kind of everything's vanity and man keeps trying to find meaning and that sense of accomplishment, something extra, the fantasy, whatever, and it's all vanity, then could it be by the time he gets to this point, what he's searching for is, what is the meaning of life? Or the purpose of man's efforts?
Well, if you're saying that what he found was evil, what could you say in terms of what he was seeking initially?
All of the physical pleasures.
Or would it be that he was searching for something good, but by contrast he found something evil?
Good. Right. Use the clues that he's given you to show that must have been the upset was because he found the Ra. Oh, so if we use deductive reasoning, it must have been that he was looking for something that was not Ra, that was not evil.
Mm-hmm.
So he was seeking out happiness, meaning he placed his heart and he used wisdom to seek out what is really going to give a person happiness. Again, he's now restarting the book, and now giving, after he gave you the foundations in terms of the fundamental problems that man has in terms of seeking modernity and ego and the immortality fantasy, all these more fundamental, these primary things. Now he's going to go in specific. But he gives you the general rule. He tells you what was he doing at the outset? What was his plan? This was my plan. And you'll see how he goes into specifics. But right now he first talks about his plan, and loosely what ended up was, even though I used wisdom, and by using wisdom what happened was I found that I was upset, it was evil. It really wasn't the good that I was looking for. And really it's a matter which is an evil and a bad matter which God has given to man to subjugate him. So evidently that is also a clue. Va'anos, the last words of 13, this is a matter, it's a difficult matter that God has given to man. Why? He tells you, because it's something which goes against man's ego. It's subjugating. It's not something where a person can just be free. And you see that Sforno quotes the opposite. The opposite is that King Tsur, who said that I am God, that I sit in God's place. You see, that's really what a person is looking for. Complete free reign. But when a person cannot find that, it's a subjugating thing, because what do you mean he's subjugated? It means, what part of man is being subjugated over here? The answer is all of man. Meaning he's finding that when I'm searching after a happiness, so the normal disposition of man, and he's talking because he understands human nature. And he's saying the normal, typical human disposition is not to have restriction. And when everything is met with there's no real happiness found, and really everything is really being very restricted. And he says further, he says in 14, he says, I have seen all the actions. Again, the same word he used earlier. The first verse, meaning 13, says, I have given my wisdom and I've searched out all that is done, all performances that are done in the sun. And he says that it's an evil matter. And in 14, he says a little bit further. He says, I've seen all these performances, all these things, these actions that are done under the sun. Meaning, again, it's all earthly. If you look at it, he says, Tachas HaShemayim or Tachas HaShemesh in both verses. Meaning anything which man is doing on earth, that's really what he's attacking. And he's trying to expose the flaws. And he says, everything, at the end of 14, he says, I've looked at all the actions that are done under the sun, and behold, everything is futile, and it's a vexation of spirit. It's an evil spirit. What do you mean spirit? So Ibn Ezra talks on this, and he says, well, the matter of, it's a an evil spirit or an evil wind, however they translate it. He says, Kamo Hevel, just like futility. Before Rove, Tialukosav, Shaloyucho, Tafsobia, because most of man's endeavors aren't things that he can really grab with his hand. And he gives different phraseologies. He says, Ruach Avor, a passing wind. And he says, it's fitting that there should be evil. But what does he mean, like, by a wind? So I think what he means over here is that what it means, a vexation of spirit, is where it's something which is a wind. See, a wind is something which is not tangible. And I think what he really may mean here is like it's an attitude, really. Something which a person is, like, if you think about what a person is really looking for in life, he always looks at a certain event, a trip, a promotion, a dinner, a competition, whatever it is. He now attaches to it a fantasy of a certain attitude that he's going to come away with it when he's involved in it or as a result of it. And he projects onto these different activities under the sun, meaning all his earthly activities. He's not guided. He hasn't researched what really is a human being to know what makes you happy. So it's an invented type of a thing which usually is attached to some ego emotion. And he feels, yeah, if I do this, this is going to give me certain happiness. But King Solomon says no. That all these different actions that you do under the sun, all right? And again, he's talking about actions. You're doing a certain thing, meaning, remember we talked last week about accomplishment? So that's one example. But this is what a person is trying to go after, but he doesn't really identify that. Usually people are just like, you know, one of the flock, and they're looking at the rest of the world, and they're following a certain path, so they just assume that this has to be a good. But he says it's a vexation of spirit, because that's all it is. Like Ibn Ezra says, you can't really put your hand on it. It's not a tangible thing. If you pick up a fruit and you eat it, that's a real thing. A person works for a fruit, he spends, you know, hours planting a field and irrigating it and watching it and tilling the soil, and finally produces, and then he eats. So that's something, there's a satisfaction there. There's a real effort, and there's a real need that's taken care of. There's nothing in the fantasy. Like, a person is not going to think about, wow, how great that is, that fruit's going to taste. He's already had the fruit. There's nothing really in terms of the fantasy, because the reality already told him what he can expect. So therefore, there's no sorrow. There's no anguish of spirit, like it says over here. But here in 14, King Solomon is talking about that, what is man going after? He's going after different attitudes. That's why he says at the end, it's a vexation of spirit, because that's what he was really involved in. He thought, if I do a certain thing, this is now going to bring the happiness. But it doesn't bring the happiness, it really brings the evil, as he said in the previous verse. So it's really these two verses are joined. Okay, right. Go ahead.
And Rabbi, is that because that essentially he's going after this ego thing, like, let's say, the promotion or the dinner or the award, because he thinks it will make him feel good. He gets there, it obviously doesn't bring him the happiness, and that's the evil?
Or it does for a moment, and then the fact that it's lost and it's now gone, and this 15 minutes of fame are over, that's something which didn't last.
Right.
And really, again, so there's different ways that something can be very disturbing to a person.
Yeah.
He can't hold on to it again. Again, it's like a wind. It's like a passing thing. And that's exactly one of the things that Ibn Ezra quotes. He says, a passing wind. So something which is just very fleeting, a person knows it's going to be over. That's it. Even during it. I mean, right now, I'm sure Bush is going through a lot of personal anguish. Even if he did a good job, there'd still be, because now that's it. The 8 years are over. So he'll start looking forward. I'll go into the circuit doing speeches and dinners and that. So that's exactly what he has to be doing. That's where all the other ex-presidents are doing that too. They can't let go of it. Anything they could do to get in front of the audience one more time. You know, same thing with musicians. The concert's over, it's a letdown. What do they do during the day? They mope around. They're waiting for the next exciting thing. They are basically basing themselves, their happiness. It's the next one that's going to really give. But the happiness doesn't last. It's just a momentary projection onto reality that I am this person now. So they feel satisfied because there is applause. But then it's gone. Once they're off stage, so it's a back and forth. That's why drugs are involved. There's other things that they're trying to use to keep a certain sense of satisfaction. Because the reality itself is not offering it to them. So again, that's what he's underlining over here. At least that's one idea. And it's a difficult book. I mean, just, you know, two or three verses over here are just very difficult for me. And, you know, there's a divergence of opinion. And the bottom line is, when you learn through this, you really have to look at the verses and let them, as Rabbi Chait said at times, just let the words talk to you. You really have to let your mind explore, because again, you know, the rabbis, the commentaries, they did not have a monopoly on all the knowledge in the Torah. So just because they wrote something down doesn't mean that this is the, you have to agree with that idea. You may see something completely new. So it should be an enjoyable thing. It shouldn't be something where we're just, you know, repetitive or we're parroting over. But it should be, you know, a real search on our own search. What exactly is he saying here? Let it really have meaning to us, each one of us, that are we satisfied with what is he saying here? We have to each explore it independently from anybody else. You know, I always tell our friends too, look at the words first, then look at the commentary, because Rashi didn't have a Rashi to look at. So what did he do? You know, he was looking at just the words, and he was able to see certain things just in the way, you know, the wisdom of the construction of the verses. That's something which is such a lost art today. It's a shame, but that's really where I see the most enjoyment, when you see the words in the verses, and the very words that create the problems, then you see clues to the answer right there, and that gives you such an appreciation for the precision that God used in putting this all together. So you see over here that he used wisdom as a tool to search after something. Now, what was the something? Well, he doesn't say what it was he was looking for. He just said, I was searching. I was searching with wisdom and all the matters that were under the heavens. What was he searching for? But then he says it was an evil matter. Oh, so now when we see his result is that I found it was really evil, that means he must have been looking for something the opposite, because this is his response. So that's a method by which we could use to determine what was his search. Okay.
Rabbi, do the commentators comment on whether, I mean, it seems reading this that Solomon is being somewhat cryptic rather than just kind of laying it out there. And some of his verses seem, their face, I think, seem to contradict other things because they figure he's specifically being cryptic, so you have to work it out, or that's just the way they wrote them.
Well, first of all, the cryptic style is the whole method of Torah, not just King Solomon. They did want to, they said, the rabbi said that they initially wanted to put away this book and put it into storage away from everybody. But they said at the end, they saw that he wrote that since everything is, after everything's been heard, you should fear God and do his mitzvos. So since that's how the book concluded, so the rabbi said that this book can stay extant in the libraries and people's hands, because King Solomon concludes they're on the right note. But you see that there was a concern, and he talks about things as if, like, he's saying it's an evil matter that God has given. But my opinion is that when he does all of this, he's doing something unique, because that was the concern of the rabbis, that it sounds like he's going against the Torah, like in terms of Proverbs or Psalms or other books, that they're all talking positively in all praises of God. Here it sounds like there is a negative tone. So that's a misleading thing. So that's, grounds for, wanting to keep it away from the people. The conclusion is that of the book is that you do fear God and you follow his commands. So that's the consideration that allowed them to keep the book out there. But why was he saying this? My personal opinion is that he's verbalizing the opinions of people. Not that these are his opinions. But like when he says that in one place, that what's better for the wise man or the fool? They both die. So why did I become wise? He asks, right? He says, let me see if I find it quickly. Yeah, it's 2:15, he says. See, first in 14, 2:14, he says, actually 2:13. You see, the themes extend through a lot of verses. 2:13, he says, and I've seen that there is a benefit to wisdom more than foolishness, just like there's a benefit to light over darkness. So that's a positive statement. That makes sense. Then he says also, the wise man, his eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Again, a very positive statement. But then he says, but I know that I too, one event will happen. Gamani shemikra echad yikra eskulam. One event will visit everybody. And I said in my heart, as is the event of the fool, so will happen to me. And why did I become wise anymore? I mean, what's the one event that happens to both? Death.
Yeah.
Right. So you see here, now, can you actually fathom that King Solomon would say that because you die, what, this is a whole new piece of knowledge to him, that because we both die, therefore wisdom is useless? I mean, it's foolish to assume that he would really say that, because he's one of the wisest persons, I think the wisest next to Moses. Remember, God gave him wisdom overnight. So it can't be this is his opinion. So my suggestion is that he's verbalizing an attitude that people have in order to catch the ear of the reader, but then he'll address it. And there's one incident in the Chumash where this happened. This is when the spies came back and they incited a riot with the people, and they terrified the people, and there was giants in the land, and we can't take it, and they're going to just devour us alive. So I think they were about to stone Moses, whatever the event was going on there, but Kalev, him and Joshua were the only two good spies who stayed true to God's word. They accepted that if we go into the land, we will be able to conquer it. It doesn't matter the size of the people. We have God on our side. So when Kalev saw that the people were all agreeing with the spies and they fell for this whole whitewash, so Kalev got up, Rashi records, and he says, "And is this all that Moses did to us?" So when the people heard that, Rashi says, they thought that he was going to continue deriding Moses for bringing us, just like he brought us to this place here, that we're going to get devoured by the inhabitants of Canaan. So they wanted to hear more dirt on Moses. So Kalev used that opportunity to quiet the people. And he says, is that all Moses did? But then he says, didn't he feed us with the manna? Didn't he bring the quails? Didn't he part the sea? So he grabbed the ear by fooling the people into thinking that he was going to continue on a path of mocking Moses, like the 10 evil spies did. So perhaps Solomon is doing this, same thing over here, that he's verbalizing a statement, and people read it, they go, yeah, that's right. I mean, he's bringing out into the open so many subtleties that people never, look at themselves. And he says, why have I become, well, yeah, it's true that the wisdom is, it's good, but then he says the opposite. Wisdom is like, light. It's as good over foolishness as light is good over darkness. But then he verbalizes a statement that, but why did I become wise? I mean, we're both going to die. So that is something which concerns people. So he brings up. That's what I think he does. And then he goes on. He says in 2:16, he says, there's no remembrance to the wise man with the fool. Right? Everything is forgotten. And how can it be that the wise man will die with the fool? Right? So those are the things that sound like he's going against the Torah. But, and when we get to it, we'll take those up. But I just wanted to give you that example of what he's doing.
Yeah, that helps. I can understand that.
Right. Like, for example, you go further over there, and he says in 2:18, he says, I hated all my work that I labored under the sun, that I should leave it over to a man that will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be wise or if he'll be foolish. And he'll rule over all my work that I had labored for, and that I became wise over under the sun. Then he says, but this is also foolish. Now, what does he mean, this is also foolish? This is a futility. See, that could mean like this. That those last words in 2:19, when he says, but this is also futility, could mean that type of a thinking is futile. Meaning that I should be bothered right now in my life about what's going to happen afterwards, whether I will leave it to a person, a son, who's wise or not, that itself is a futile type of a thing, because you're worrying about something which really has no impact on your own perfection. But he's verbalizing what people do get concerned about, and what do they do get anguished over. And like the people who just work their entire lives, they labor away, they pile up a sum of money, so not only are they not enjoying the money, but then they're bothered by this thought, this insecurity about, well, I didn't use it, but hopefully I'll have a good son and he'll be wise with my money, but now I have to worry. Maybe I won't have a wise son. And then he'll just, squander it, aimlessly, foolishly. But that thinking, I think, is what he's saying, is a futility.
Yeah,
right? Not that he worked and he left it to somebody and then he's going to use it foolishly, because again, I mean, the perfection of a person is really what he did in his life. So what is he saying is the foolishness, all right? Rashi, however, says that what this means is that this is one of the things in the world that are futile, that are created in the world, that a wise man will labor and a fool will inherit it. But again, that perhaps that futility means that, like I'm saying, it's futile if you go down that path and you think that way. Because honestly, why should it affect the person's real values and his enjoyment and living his life of chachma and being a good person and you know, enjoying the wisdom and the time with his family? Why should he be? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that a wise person will allow the thought that a potential inheritor will waste his money. That, all right, listen, I'm not going to be in the world at that point anyway. So really, there's not going to have any negative impact on me. It just doesn't make sense to me that is something that an intelligent person like Solomon is bothered by. But he verbalizes it, perhaps, in order to unveil the many, many facets of human life where people have pent-up energies and concerns, and there's a myriad of things that bother a person. Okay. Slight tangent. But we can blame that on Doug's big question.
I'll accept that blame.
Okay. All right, so now we're back at... there's one more verse I want to do. And that's going back to where we just did 1, 13, and 14. All right? He's looking for happiness. That's something we had to deduce because he says, but I only found evil. And it's something which God is doing to subjugate man, because really man wants to have that freedom. And that was the Sforno who cited the case of the king, Tzur, who fancied himself in being in God's place. That's really where a person wants to be. All right? And... that's really the whole race for the White House. I mean, that's all that is. You never have in history one candidate who said, you know, I think my opponent is more correct than I am, and I'm bowing out. I'm sure plenty of times there are plenty of, you know, races to the White House where there are all these different candidates. Every single person always felt that he was right. I mean, that's just purely foolish. A person can't be right all the time. All right, so, and he saw all the actions, meaning actions per se is what he talked about in both verses, right? He saw both in verse 13 and 14, and I saw all the events, the actions that took place, meaning man's plans, all the plans that man has contrived. And he was looking for something, but it all ended up to be a vexation of spirit. Because he was looking for something that he just projected that would, now, this is now going to make me happy. But now, it was very interesting, he says one more verse over here. And, you know, we have to really know how to join the verses, what's a group of verses and what's not. But you see the next verse, he says, what is crooked cannot be made fixed or straightened, and that which is lacking, you cannot... count. Cannot be counted. And you look at also the next verse, 16, you see he goes on to a new topic. So this tells us to stop here. Because in the next verse he says, I spoke in my heart and I said, behold, I have become great and I have increased in wisdom over all those that were before me in Jerusalem. So you see now he's doing a contemplative type of a thought. So therefore, he's moving on to a new idea. So we know that we have to stop after verse 15. But what is he, how is he closing off these three verses now by saying that which is crooked or distorted cannot become fixed? and that which is lacking you cannot count. Very enigmatic, like you said before, Doug. I mean, it's cryptic. Why is he doing that? And what's the relevation, you know, the relevance to the previous verse?
I don't think I necessarily tried to connect the two.
But you're saying that man has an attempt at his... Just say it again.
Well, so man has this search that we've been talking about in the earlier verses for some sense of accomplishment or something extra over and above just the practicality. And so what Solomon is saying is what is lacking can't be counted. In other words, that desire that's searching for that something is a fantasy. It doesn't really exist. So since it's not really there, you can't count it or measure it.
But there is something that's lacking, evidently, because it says that which is lacking cannot be counted. He doesn't say, let's see, does that mean that it's absent, or it's just the quantity is just not meeting the right level?
Yeah, ours said what is missing will not be able to be counted. Now, I don't know if that means something that actually should be there and isn't, or something that simply isn't there by definition.
Right.
But people keep trying to get their arms around it so they can have it.
It seems to me like that second part is connected to the first part, which is, you know, what is twisted, or how does it say?
One's crooked will not be able to be straightened.
Yeah, when you're going down a path that an incorrect idea or not in alignment with purpose, it doesn't produce anything. And so then that applies to the second part, which means that there's nothing to be gained from it because there was nothing there to begin with.
Right.
If you start down a crooked road and go a ways down it, it's not like you can straighten it out because your whole premise is wrong. So you've got to go way back to the beginning and start with a completely different premise.
Right.
I agree with that. I want to try to explain this, though, in the context, and I don't think there's much difference than what I'm going to tell you, but I think what he's doing is he's explaining why 13 and 14 are accurate statements, meaning why there is it's painful and all he found was evil, and that all the actions that man does under the sun, that they're all vexation of spirit and it just wearies him out, there's nothing there. I think what he says is the reason is because of verse 15, and that is that which is crooked you can't make straight, meaning something which has a certain quality of negativity from the outset, it's like you're trying to build a bicycle with only one wheel. So from the outset, the impossibility to have success is there because what you're working with is lacking, meaning in terms of the quality, But there could also be problems just in terms of quantity, which the next one is. Something which is lacking in number can't be counted. And I was talking about number, quantity, meaning qualitative. I mean, if there's two qualities, and I'm going to use that word again, but there are, actually let's use the word categories. There's two categories as to why these verses are true about 13 and 14. Why, when man chases after things in the world, that he just finds that it's unfulfilling. And that's because in the physical world, the physical world itself is inherently lacking in a quantitative and a qualitative basis. Okay, I mean, that's really where man is going to look. For example, a person's chasing after money all the time. So that's a quantitative lack. He's now looking for happiness that comes from a quantitative issue. Then there's also the qualitative. I mean, the quality. A person is not going to be happy unless he can fly, but that's an impossibility. So that quality is just something which, meaning if a person is looking for things for happiness, where he looks is categorically in those two areas. A lot, I'm going to travel all the time, you know, maybe another traveling, but another trip is going to make me happy. You know, people constantly travel, they keep on going after it because they're looking for something that's not there. So that going after a quantitative increase is not going to help, whether it's travel or money, things of that nature, sexual partners, the amount of foods at a dinner, or if a person is just looking for a certain quality, like, oh, I'm going to be the speaker at that dinner, but guess what? The dinner's over in 2 hours, and now what? So a person is looking for certain qualities. So I think perhaps what he's saying is that since the world inherently is not designed, God didn't make the physical world, that this is really where you're getting your happiness from. It's to be a tool to be used in the right context in the pursuit of wisdom, to humble yourself, to appreciate wisdom. If that's how you're approaching the world, so then you're never looking at the physical as the be-all and end-all. So then you won't have this vexation of spirit. But the reason why people do get depressed and worn out and upset is because they're looking for something in the physical world. But the answer to that is that which is crooked cannot be straightened. The physical world is not made perfect. Things rust. People get old. We get wrinkles on our face. We get gray. We lose strength. Right? I mean, that's something which is par. So don't be looking in these areas of the physical, you know, the physical perfection. And also in the physical, you know, perfection is the fact that things, you know, there's a quantitative lacking as well. A person wants to have a big house, but there's only a certain amount of property he can purchase in the town he lives. It's everywhere. So, you know, popularity. How many people like me? You know, that's another area of a quantitative. So I think perhaps that's what he's saying this at this point, is just to explain now why verses 13 and 14 are true. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. But that doesn't, it's not an argument on what you're saying, you know, Cal, that, you know, or actually how you embellished it, you know, Doug, that if you start with a crooked premise, yes, that's also true. Then you have to go back to the beginning. You can't make something, you know, if your premises are incorrect. So certainly anything which is, you know, a product of them will also be incorrect.
Yeah, yours ties in nicely, though. Ours is sort of an idea that hangs out there, and it doesn't make sense why you would throw that in right at that point.
Right. Hey, Josh, you had a question?
Yeah, well, I was just, you know, looking at the structure of the section, like 12 through 15 here. You know, the possible, yeah, 12 is kind of like an introductory statement. We got 13 and 14, which are kind of parallel statements. And then really, 15, I'd say A and B are also parallel statements that kind of, you know, is it possible like 15A applies to verse 13 and B is going with verse 14?
In what way do they parallel?
I'm not exactly sure, but in 13,
well, I wouldn't.
It's an evil Mine says it's a sorry task that God's given the sons of man, but there's a similarity between like a crooked thing and an evil thing. And in 14, it says, you know, it's all futile. You just say it's like hevel. It's like it's not there. You know, you can't count what's not there. It's like a, like there seems to be some kind of...
Well, he doesn't say it's not there in 14. He doesn't talk about...
This version says it's not there, but maybe it's lacking in yours.
That's only in 15.
Right.
No, see the way I'm looking at 13 and 14 is that 13 is what he set out to do. 14 are the results. He set out to inquire, but all he found was being upset, and that it was a something which was humbling. So that's the attitude that hit man, that hit King Solomon at that point. And then his calculation, he talks about in 14. I've seen all the matters under the sun, and everything is really just a vexation of spirit. Now he gives you his assessment of what he found. 13 is really the personal response, so I wouldn't parallel them. You see the difference?
I'm not sure. You say that again?
That 13 is talking about what he set out to do. I placed my heart, I gave my heart over to inquire with wisdom to see everything that was under the sun, under the heavens. All right, hold on 1 second. I just got to get the other phone. This one's running out. Hold on. I don't see them as parallel. It seems to be two different statements. What he was planning on doing, what he discovered in general, that it's an upsetting matter that God has given to the sons of man to subjugate them. So that's the process. That's the endeavor that we have been placed here. And so he's talking about the actual pursuit. That's 13. In 14, he talks about the observations and the assessment of those observations. Completely different topic. But then it's up to us to determine why. Meaning when he says that it's a vexation of spirit, or why is it a vexation of spirit? Why is that the response psychologically that man has? Evidently, something was lacking. Something was not really being fulfilled. That's why the next verse comes in. He had a certain projection onto reality that he wanted to get from certain futile pursuits, but it was a vexation of spirit. Why? Verse 15 tells you, because inherently the pursuits the man is going after are not designed for that. They are built to be limited. God didn't create the physical world that it should be straight, that it should perfectly be aligned. Like, for example, it says when God created trees, he said there should be fruit trees bearing fruit. So Rashi explains that God's original command was that the tree should also be made of edible fruit. The actual bark and the wood should be equivalent to the fruit itself. But when the tree actually came into existence, it was only a tree bearing fruit. So it was like the tree rebelled against God. But of course, a tree doesn't have free will. But that idea is to show you that God has a preference in terms of the world could or should be completely perfect. I can just walk over to the bark of a tree and bite the tree off and just enjoy that as much as the fruit. That would be even better, right? That's more fruit for me to have. But you see that God did not want the world to have something where man was completely satisfied with the physical. Then he wouldn't look for the world of Chachma. He wouldn't look for the world of wisdom. So the world had to be built in a way where there was frustration built. That's what God says to Adam. the thorns and thistles will sprout, because since you went ahead and you disobeyed my command, and you took from the fruit that I commanded you not to, so one of the punishments was that now there's going to be a frustration built. You're going to toil a lot, but it's not going to yield you anything but thorns and thistles, and meaning that there's going to be frustration in the physical world. But that was a blessing, because since man just completely put his energies into the physical and disregarded God's command, now God did was he put something in the physical world to steer us away from trying to satisfy ourselves completely physically. Because had the physical world been perfect with trees that were equivalent to the fruit, I could just bite off the bark and have that as well. I would not look anywhere else for happiness. So if a person is looking that way and that's where he's looking for his happiness in the physical world, that's the critique of verse 14. And this is and explains why there has to be a dissatisfaction and a great frustration because of verse 15. Because the world is inherently limited, both in terms of quality, that which is crooked, can't be straightened out, and quantity. Okay?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
He doesn't really, I guess, yet at this point, he's just kind of leaving that as an open, like he hasn't drawn the full conclusion of why things are like that. He's just coming to the conclusion that that's how things are.
Yeah, that's how the world is.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we're going to get all the answers here because I'm, you know, he says a lot and we'll do our best, you know, as we go through. But let's see, it's already time today. So what we do is pick up from here next week. So we're going to be starting with 1:16. All right, we'll look at those next few verses. Try to get the context. And try to see where you think the next section ends. So that's very important to know that you're not, you know, overrunning and going after more than the area that he's really addressing. So look for you know, different clues as to where you think you should stop, and then just work on those verses and try to get a structure as to what he's doing.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Last time, and I don't know if it can be done in sort of a... You had asked us to see if we see any parallels in Genesis with what we talked about today. And Doug and I kind of concluded with, you know, in the beginning of Genesis, in those first creations, God said that it was good. Well, we were really struggling with parallels there. It was sort of like... I guess the only thing I could see was that God was looking at his creation and saying it was good, but then here, King Solomon or Aquilus is looking back at all this and saying that the pursuits of man is not good. Sort of it, as a reflection on what is there, like a creation in a sense. What man created.
So you're asking why he's arguing on God? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm just asking what is the parallels that you said you had wanted us to go back to Genesis and see if we could see any parallels.
Right, that was in the first chapter there. Well, you see he's talking about, let's say, for example, rivers. You have that in Genesis 2.
Okay, I see that.
You're talking about verses 1 through 12, but maybe we misunderstood. We were thinking that you were indicating there was some parallel in verses 13 and beyond.
Oh, no. So. No, the first ones.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, just loosely speaking, what I was suggesting is that in both books, we're learning about human nature before the real main content of the book starts. So it's necessary that we have a backdrop of understanding what is man. So just like over here in Koheles, he's telling you about certain primary, you know, fundamental features of the human psyche, and like immortality fantasy, and the need for accomplishment, and he really is bringing that out into the open. So I believe Genesis also does that, and it talks about, that's something you really have to do on your own, because you're not to... really supposed to, like, in the areas of Genesis, so that should be something which is not, like, publicly discussed. So that's, I guess, because, you know, there's a lot of deep ideas over there. And normally should be the rabbi saying, I think there's just one person to another person. And even then, just the head categories should be suggested to. So I guess why they're saying that is that if you're really not on the level, the person's not on the level yet to grasp these ideas, so then it keeps it obscured and then it won't hurt the person. The person won't think it's something which is not. Okay. All right, so we'll wrap it up over here. Any other questions, by the way?
I don't think so.
No, we're good.
Good. All right. All right, so pick up a week from today, and we'll start from 116 is where we're up to.
Oh, Rabbi, you mentioned that back in verse 12, when you were reading Rashi, you said there's a Talmudic reference on this?
Yeah, I'll take a look and see what that is, and I'll get a hold of that for you.
Oh, okay, you don't have that up top of your head.
No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, if you find it, I'd be curious to look.
Okay. Yeah, it's a whole midrashic thing. I'll have to go into it. A real, very, you think this is cryptic. So I'll have to take a look at that.
Okay.
See if it's really, you know, it may just take us too far afield.
Yeah.
Alrighty then.
Very good. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure, as always, and I look forward to continuing next week.
All right. You have a great week.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.